This is Peter Taylor in an unscripted podcast titled, When We Get to a Challenging Place, Then Stop. It's about episodes when fields get to some interesting place and then they drop the ball. The fields that I will describe, the episodes, come from ecology, evolution biology, social studies of science, epidemiology and population health, and then life in general. So the first episode is from ecological theory in the 1970s. A theoretical ecologist, formerly a mathematical physicist, Robert May, showed that complexity doesn't necessarily give stability in ecosystems. There is a sense, a popular sense, it still continues to this day, that, say, the Amazon rainforest or the coral reef is very complex, has lots of diverse species in interacting, and that's an exemplar of a stable system. Well, in his mathematical models, he showed that as systems gain in complexity, they are less likely to be stable. But some people, including Alan Roberts, who died quite recently in Australia, and then later myself as a student of Alan's, and then in my own work, showed that those systems that are complex and stable may be quite rare, but they're very easy to construct over time by adding species to a model, seeing whether it takes, seeing whether it knocks some out, seeing whether it gets knocked out itself, and then continuing this construction and turnover. When I first presented this as a graduate student, Robert May was in the audience, and he came up and talked to me about it. He had a way of saying what I was doing was a form of evolution, which is what he'd described. He said, complex systems may be rare, but there'll be some special adaptation, some special evolution that will get to them. I think evolution to me involves the adaptations through natural selection. This construction and turnover is more like, you know, if all the trees were blown over in an island and, or if, say, an island came, arose out of the sea from volcanic activity, gradually it would be colonized, and those colonizers would make space and conditions for more things to colonize. A process that's called succession. Now, over the years since, this result about construction and turnover hasn't been overthrown, but it hasn't been taken up, including by Robert May himself. There's a lot of discussion that comes up every few years about how complexity leads to instability. It's now the conventional wisdom. There has to be some special way that systems get designed by evolution for them to be stable. So that's an example where there was an insight, a leading figure in the field acknowledged it, and yet it hasn't been taken up. Let me give another one from ecology as well. A lot of ecological theory has focused on, say, close species, whether they can coexist, whether one will knock the other out in a process called competitive exclusion. A lot of mathematical models of competitive exclusion involve the two species in some sort of interaction with each other. An ecologist and mathematical ecologist also, John van der Meer, did some experiments with protozoa coexisting, growing on their own, growing in pairs, and then growing in four species interactions. They were being fed by some nutrient medium that had bacteria in that the protozoa consumed. In his analysis, he showed that these protozoan species, which we would think would be competitors, they're all feeding on the same nutrient, some of them were best fit by mathematical equations that meant they were actually predator preys, or they appeared to be predator preys. Now, they weren't actually predator preys, but they appeared to be so because the model only included those four protozoans. It didn't include the dynamics of the food that they depend on. So those interactions weren't really predator-prey interactions. They're just apparent predator-prey interactions where those apparent interactions had to somehow incorporate the dynamics of the species that had been left out of the model. So if you explore that basic problem, you realize that any model of part of a complex dynamic system in ecology is going to have components that are in the model and components that are not included in the model that have their own dynamics, so that those dynamics have to somehow be incorporated into the specifications for the species that you are including in the model. So the question might then arise, how well can you model the subsystem doing it in such a way that it implicitly incorporates the dynamics of the things that aren't in your model? Well, one way to explore this is to play God and build the complete model. Generate the data and then consider the data for just a subsystem and then fit the best model to that and see whether it matches your intuition about what those species should do. Well, when I did this work in the early 1980s, I discovered that very often it doesn't match your intuition. Just like van der Meer's protozoan species that appeared to be predator-prey, when we knew they're actually just competing for a common resource, this was a general phenomenon that the dynamics of the species which you left out of the model couldn't be incorporated in any intuitive way into the model of the subsystem and still have general results. You know, in some cases it worked, but in most cases it didn't. When I first presented this for publication, one of the reviewers said, "This seems like an insoluble problem," and recommended rejection of the paper. Why was it insoluble? It was because you could only know how badly the model that just focused on the subsystem was doing by knowing the full system. And if you knew the full system, why not model it? Well, from my point of view, if this was an insoluble problem, the field should know about it. It should know that any reliance on mathematical models of a subsystem, when the remaining part of the system, the part that you didn't model, had dynamics of its own, was going to be unreliable. Okay, so there are two cases where a field gets to a challenging place and then it stops or blocks further investigation. The next case comes from discussions of Darwin's theory of natural selection. Here I have to lay out the basis of the theory so that I can explain the challenging place. So Darwin's theory involves four components. The first component is that there are There is variation among the organisms in a species. That variation, which is at least partially inherited, so if the parents are like, parents like A tend to have offspring like A, and parents like B tend to have offspring like B. It's not the other way around, that parents of A have offspring like B and parents of B have offspring like A, which would just be randomly sort of sorting it. So you've got variation, you've got inheritance of that variation. And then you've got you've got differential survival of the variants. Not all variants survive. There are too many to survive and reproduce. So which ones survive? But as long as, you know, so not all survive and reproduce. So if you have those three components, you'll get evolution. It'll mean there'll be some way to trace from the ancestor to the present, and there'll be the variation that you had in the original population will change over time. So that's evolution. But then if you say which variants survive best, the answer is the ones that are best fit to the environment, where the environment may include finding mates to reproduce. Best fit in this case means like a lock and a key. It means the marvelous co-adaptation which most excites our admiration, in Darwin's own words. Okay, so that seems plausible. But then if we ask, how do we identify the features, the characteristics that lead you to be best fit to the environment? Darwin himself, in chapter 3 of On the Origin of Species, basically says, well, don't ask me to tell you, it's all too complicated. You know, it's like the apparent interactions case I mentioned. He describes places where just enclosing a field leads to all sorts of different changes in the species. He's basically saying, yep, in principle, there must be some things that are more fit to the environment. But if we have to look at the actual situation, we have to observe it and identify what it was that led to that being most fit in a way that led to more offspring, it's really hard to do. Well, it's been a century and a half since Darwin's time, so maybe people have got better at it. But what the field tended to do was to say, well, the first thing it did is it stopped talking about fitness in terms of lock and key and started to just say you're more fit if you leave more offspring. So this is the tautology, which is saying which ones are most fit, the ones that lead to more offspring. And the theory says the ones that are more fit will lead to more offspring. So tautology meaning you've just identified fitness in terms of the thing you were trying to prove. There are many compilations now of cases that are supposedly of natural selection, but when you examine them carefully, most of them are about places where they different variants change in proportion over time, which is just the fact of evolution. It's not the fact of explaining evolution in terms of which ones are differentially surviving because of some aspect that fits the environment well. The cases that I learned in biology were ones where I would call it the environment's pretty heavy-handed. They're like DDT resistance in flies. If you're being sprayed by DDT and you're not resistant, you're out. Heavy metal tolerance in plants, on mine wastes. If you're not tolerant of the heavy metals, you'll shrivel away and you won't have seeds. So it's a great challenge in a given that all organisms are existing in a complex environment, well, most organisms are in a complex environment, more complex than the heavy-handed cases of heavy metal tolerance or DDT resistance. To identify what characteristic would improve the survival chances of the organism and its reproductive chances, and follow that through and see that that actually happened over time. So a lot of work that's done under evolution just tries to say, well, I've mentioned catalogs of things where we've shown changes in the variation over time, but you also have a lot of work that tries to show how well adapted something is to the environment. That's like a snapshot, not a historical case, not something which is showing, yes, it may be well adapted, though there are a lot of just those stories that then get debunked, but we don't have the history to show that the thing that's adapted now arose by a process of differential survival because it had that adaptation. You might say it seems obvious, so you might be prepared to stop at this challenging place or not even find it challenging. But you may instead say, okay, what we've got here is a case of historical explanation of a historical process, and we've got to work out how to do that. Science is not just the nice theory of Darwin's, it's also that, you know, that theory as it's applied to observations, interpreting observations. The two have to go together. Okay, let me shift from biology to social studies of science. In my own work, I was always interested in where questions came from and why people accepted the answers they did in biology. So that quickly led me to say, well, let's look at the social context in which people are producing their science and getting it accepted. So I was also trying to make sense of my own work, which I'd done in the 1970s in Australia as a young researcher on contract research, trying to make sense of the different factors that had shaped our science. And I was identifying many different kinds of things that went into our work, ranging from the computer software that was available to the hierarchical relations in the workplace to the short-termness of the contract research. So I had an idea which I would now call that the work was built from heterogeneous resources. And at that time, I came across a newly published book by Bruno Latour called Science in Action. And he was also making the point that science gets built. If you follow scientists in action, you see them mobilizing heterogeneous resources. So I said, great. So the question was, how do you analyze? How do you make sense? How do you expose and then analyze and communicate to other people the heterogeneous resources? How do you show that something was a resource rather than just something that happened to be? You know, like in those days, I used a fountain pen rather than a ballpoint pen. You'd probably say, yeah, I mean, I needed to write, so it was a resource, but it wasn't an important resource in shaping the science. So how do you make those kind of decisions, determinations? So I was quite eager to see the way Latour and Latour's students and colleagues were doing it. What actually happened was what he promoted and what people picked up was the idea that these resources could include non-human living things and non-living things altogether. The resources were heterogeneous and so on. So they called them actants, or sometimes said they're all actors. So there was a lot of emphasis on pointing out that it's not just humans who shape science, humans with their interests and funding and so on, humans with their motivations and will. Lots of other things got to be actants. And there wasn't much attention to the challenge of analyzing the heterogeneous resources. In my own work, I would say the distinction about living and non-living, human and non-human, was not very important conceptually, because whenever we tried to think about mobilizing a non-living resource, making it a resource, you might say, we were very quickly brought into interactions among people. So you're never away from a process where people were trying to employ, do something with heterogeneous resources. So I would advocate not taking the people out or not making them just another actant, because people do have wills and fountain pen ink doesn't. People are shaped by their life histories and fountain pen ink isn't. But there was a case where there was a challenging place, I think, had been identified by Latour and others around 1987, and then the field stopped, didn't take it up. One of the ways that I tried to take it up was to get scientists to pay attention to the heterogeneous resources in their work, and by sharing that with others, imagining that they could do it differently, perhaps collaborate, see opportunities that they hadn't seen by interacting with these others and explaining their work in this way. So I co-ran some workshops where we tried to get scientists to do that, and I wanted more people to be thinking about how to make those workshops work well, and or just the whole enterprise of getting scientists to be the ones that were trying to reflect on their work on the heterogeneous resources and make changes. So we tried to publish an article about these workshops just to say, here they are. We didn't say this proves X or Y. We just said they exist. And one of the reviewers came back and said, as Stanley Fish shows, being aware of your situatedness, meaning all the different resources that are involved in your research, is no guarantee of being able to inhabit that situatedness more effectively. So I followed up who this Stanley Fish was, and he was an interpreter of literature and legal practices, particularly a Milton scholar, and he had promoted an anti-foundational stance. There was no foundation that would guarantee that you had the correct interpretation of the text. So that sense that your interpretation depended upon your situation was very much in sync with my sense that in doing applied research, that there'd been many different resources shaping our science. But I thought to myself, who needs a guarantee that workshops that get people to be more self-conscious about their heterogeneous resources will lead them to a more effective practice? Who needs a guarantee? In the world of foundationalism, foundations give you some guaranteed position, but a world of anti-foundationalism, we shouldn't be looking for guarantees. We should be saying, let's try it out. Let's see what happens. And that's another case, I think, where a field got to a place of paying attention to situatedness, being anti-foundationalist, and then stopped or blocked certain avenues of exploration. Getting into social studies of science, I became aware of the different fields, history, philosophy, political analysis, and then anthropology. So in anthropology, the field had begun in the late 70s into the 80s to turn away from field work in exotic places to issues closer to home, and it started to be anthropologists of science. So reading their work, I would be fascinated by their ethnography, their descriptions of fine-scale descriptions of the way people act, talk, collaborate, respond to ideas about the larger social context, and so on. And yet, at a certain point, they would show their credentials as social critics, or as people critical of social order, and invoke power. Now, power was something which it's much harder to observe power ethnographically. Power doesn't come in like a 400 or 800 pound gorilla into the room and say, I'm power. It has to be inferred from people's interactions. So people would say, well, we're not talking about power, we're talking about micro power. I think that's fine. If a person was making their science out of heterogeneous resources and suggested trying to do it differently, as I had done when I was a young researcher, there gets to be pushback. And you get to see the implications for other people of you changing your actions. So you could say that this was power operating. But I didn't really need to say that. I just needed to point to the different resources and the different possibilities for changing it and the challenge of analyzing which ones were going to be more important, or the challenge of getting to explore it in practice rather than having a good analysis in advance. So I was always interested that the challenge in place that ethnography gets to, which is your observing, following, participating with actual people and their actual work and lives, pulls out this big thing of power to try to say something about the wider social context that we all do work in and has become in different ways embodied in our bodies and so on. Another form of social studies of science, which gets to a challenging place, then stops, in my view, is grounded theory, situational analysis. So in grounded theory, you've got interested in some area, some topic, but you spend a lot of time observing again and making transcripts. And then you analyze those transcripts with qualitative analysis software and so on until you start to see the themes that are coming up, the themes that are, that the people you're observing are using. So you don't begin with a theory that the people then need to, their action needs to support or not. You let the theory come from the themes that come from your observation of people in their grounding. The same field of research, grounded theory, would often, perhaps to draw attention to the significance of what it was doing, or to extrapolate from the significance in some particular setting to some wider significance, would talk about what I call isations. So we're very familiar in our history with things like industrialization. The Industrial Revolution led to the industrialization. And in grounded theory in biology, around biology, there would be the biomedicalization of life. As if all the different themes that emerged in this place or in that place that was being studied fitted under or made sense or had significance, given that there was some larger transition going on, some biomedicalization of the health system or of social policy or whatever. And it may be a quite reasonable generalization, quite reasonable description, but once you have this isation, this capital P process, it creates the idea that it's happening because there's some process that, once it's got going, keeps going. It has a life of its own. It doesn't depend upon the individual sites that you'd been observing. It's like industrialization. We do think, oh, once it started, it can't stop. That's the way we were told our history. Okay, so at some point in the biology of my interest shifted from ecological complexity to complexities of health in its social context. So I began to study epidemiology and try to make sense of both the practice and the practitioners. And I remember early on interviewing people who we could call social epidemiologists, people who were paying attention to a variety of social factors that build up over people's lifetimes, of course, affecting the biology, because health is about how the biological organism actually works or stops working, of course. So they would come up with results that incorporated many different factors. And I would ask, so do policymakers pay any attention to you? And no, I would ask, can you give me some examples where policymakers paid attention to you? And they would often get a sad look in their eye. And if they told you a case, it was cases where policymakers picked up some aspect of the research, but got it wrong and went in the direction that wasn't justified by the research. So I think you can be, as a epidemiologist or population health researcher, you can be upset by that once or twice, but not really three times or more, because then you are looking at social factors that shape the people's health. Then you realize you need to look at the social factors that shape the reception of results, and or at least you're in this challenging place, and that's an avenue that's opened up to you. Now, of course, some of them, the researchers in population health, get to be influential figures, but the rank and file haven't taken up that challenge of incorporating the social analysis of their knowledge making and reception into their very methods of research. Another example that struck me from population health was hearing a particular researcher at a very big plenary at the American Public Health Association in 2008. It was actually the American election date in 2008. Talk about the excess deaths that happened because people in, it was in first in the Boston area and then and wider across the United States, didn't have the health status of the best off in their communities. So there's a counterfactual there. If people could have the health status of the best off, you know, then there would be many more years of life and many fewer deaths. And the speaker voice was shaky. She may have even been crying and certainly got the audience to think about all those lives lost, all those years of life lost. On that day, there was some hope that there could be, with a change of government, there could be a change in that outcome. But you have to say, how does a description of the health status lead to policy? It may come from shock at the figures, or shame at the figures. But again, it may not come from that. So what is the way in which results are supposed to affect action? Now, the person involved, the person speaking, and I suspect most of the audience being the American Public Health Association, are committed, concerned. I'm not criticizing their commitment and concern. I'm just saying they get to a challenging place of saying, how do our descriptions of health inequalities get translate into actions that can be taken? It's certainly true, just stepping aside from epidemiology for a while, that I've, over the years, since the very first days that I was involved in applied social and environmental research, that I would encounter people who lamented having produced this report and then not had the policymakers use it and the policymakers shelve it, or had a change of government so it wasn't taken up. Or in some cases, and this was certainly true when I reflected back on my early research in Australia, the times weren't right for some of the options that were highlighted by the research. But the time would get right 5 years later, 10 years later. Things like, well, I won't fill you in the details, but the idea of domestic waste being turned into compost and then returned for a more sort of organic agriculture. But let's go back to epidemiology. Anyway, so there would be people complaining, and I would think you can't complain more than twice before you start to say, look, this has got to be part of my problematique. You know, do I accept this research contract, or do I get it reshaped? Do I shift my focus to analyze the political dynamics, build up new skills so that I can not just be someone producing the results and then suffering them being ignored. Another case from epidemiology and public health where a field gets to a challenging place and then stops, I think, is the very notion of a regression equation or a risk factor. You know, in population health, the major risk factors for coronary heart disease in a society are the level of smoking, the level of high blood pressure, the level of lipids, or the bad lipids, bad fats, and the level of diabetes. So you can create an equation that includes those risk factors and make predictions at the cardiac fatalities or cardiac incidents for one population versus another. And those factors that I've mentioned are changeable. So you imagine that those risk factors are actually factors you can change. But sometimes in epidemiology, there are risk factors that can't be changed. The gender, whether you're designated male or female, but they can still fit into your predictions. And sometimes the risk factors are ones which, when people did find ways to change them, didn't turn out to be the causal factors. They must have been associated with some other factor, like something called C-reactive protein is associated with higher cardiac incidents. But a line of research has shown that, you know, it would seem to be related to inflammation of the arteries, so it seemed to be something that may be causing the heart attacks, but it turns out it's a symptom rather than a cause in itself. But you have these regression equations, and you have the items in it are called risk factors, so it predisposes people to think that they are things that you need to change to improve the conditions. But regressions aren't, that's not what regressions mean, and I think most researchers, if you pin them down, would admit that. Let me give you an example. It's not from epidemiology, but in the earlier research I did, I was trying to come up with equations to predict the yield of different crop plants in relationship to the different factors that affect it, the amount of irrigation water, the amount of fertilizer, the amount of salt in the soil, the makeup of the soil. Well, I was getting data at least on water, irrigation water and fertilizer for some crops. And the best way to fit that data, the best regression equation, had one of those factors, I can't remember whether it was water or fertilizer, having a positive coefficient. So if there was more water, there was higher yield in the data, and the other having a negative coefficient. If there was more fertilizer, there was less yield. And when you look at that intuitively, you say, no, fertilizer is about increasing the yield of plants and water. So they both should be positive, and that's what my boss said. But I said, no, we're just trying to fit the past patterns the best way we can with this regression equation. We don't expect that it's really about the causes. Well, he did, I didn't. In the actual project, we went on to find other ways to make predictions based on the local knowledge of the agricultural field workers and so on. So we didn't get these multifactorial regression equations. But in the field of population health and epidemiology, you often do. And I think the field has got to a challenging place where risk factors are just items in a regression equation that aren't necessarily causal. And population health is a field that wants to be able to make policy recommendations as to what factors should be changed when those factors take place in a wider social context. Let me give you an example. You can have a regression equation that shows that the health in a community is related to the average income in that community. And someone can come along and say, okay, so average income is a risk factor. More income is a protective factor. So let's do an experiment and give some of the people in that community $10,000. We're going to increase their income. Well, that would make sense if you think a risk factor translates from being an element in a regression equation, fitting the data, to a causal element. But I think you can sort of suspect that doing that experiment and giving people $10,000 doesn't really cut it, because there's all sorts of reasons why those people got to have less income. It's the availability of jobs in that area, availability of public transport. It's the educational system that goes back over the years before they became adults. It's the crime level that makes it difficult to have the free movement or the concentration or even the best use of your intelligence. I'm making up all these different things, but you can find, I think you can find it very plausible that the dynamics that lead people to having a lower income is not a dynamic that simply gets changed when you give someone more money. The dynamics are still there. The regression equation just took a snapshot or a slice through the wealth of data, the wealth of factors on which data was collected. I'm going to shift now from epidemiology, though, to a more current situation where I think people get to a really interesting place and then they stop or drop the inquiry. So in the 2016 election, there were various areas of the country with the electoral college system that swung enough that Donald Trump got elected. And people would try to say, what happened in those places? And in those places, you would find that there were working class white men who had voted for Obama, who then voted for Trump. And people then said, and got them to say, and gave them a megaphone for saying, and the president himself keeps saying, you'll never be forgotten again. So there came to be a narrative that said the election was swung because white working class men had been left behind by globalization, and the elites, who somehow were more common in the Democratic Party, had turned their back on them and forgotten them, had assumed that they would vote for the Democrats, had taken them for granted, and they got the candidate they wanted, someone who said, I'm going to pay attention to you. I'll fix it. Well, as weeks went on, we also saw other things that evangelists had come out, who hadn't voted the previous time, had come out and voted for Trump. We also found that African Americans in those states and in other places had stayed at home and not voted. So we found, and we also found, that there were plenty of white working class men who voted for Obama, who voted for Clinton. There were perhaps more of them. So the overall narrative that the white working class had voted, and that was the shift. Well, there's more complexity to it. And as time went on, we started to discover more about how there was targeting in these areas, just like there was targeting in the Brexit campaign. Brexit campaign also had this narrative that the places outside the city of London had been forgotten by the governing elites, and they now got a chance. But when you looked into Brexit, for example, you found out that there were some places where there'd been election publicity that suggested that the European Union was going to restrict kosher foods, and those areas happened to have a high proportion of Jewish voters, and they were swung by it. And in other areas, there were other, that was not correct, or not correct in any significant way. It was a targeted fake news. And in many areas, there was targeted advertising to match the particular demographics. So the country was made up of many different demographics, many heterogeneous demographics, and by targeting them, perhaps some of the targeting was highlighting their real interests, but I, unfortunately, as far as I can tell, a lot of it was targeting them with fake news. And or overly grand pronouncements, like somehow the Trump as president could bring back coal jobs. He would stop the war on coal. And in the United States, there was a lot of targeting of African Americans to highlight the things that had been done under previous Democratic, particularly under the Bill Clinton. And there's a correlation between that kind of advertising and just staying home from the vote. You know, not voting for Trump, but not voting for Clinton. So there's a lot of micro-targeting, and yet the conversation, the national conversation, is on the single narrative. People slipped very quickly into explaining the result as if it's the result of a pendulum that just swung back or got pushed back. And that's what needs to be paid attention to, rather than staying with the heterogeneity. And I think even if we don't have firms like Cambridge Analytica doing the micro-targeting for us in the next campaign, it'll be an approach that can't go away now. Once its power has been shown, the question is how much of the micro-targeting will be with fake advertising and how much will be with actually paying attention to saying, look, here is the way in coal country the Democratic policies are going to produce employment. We'll have to see. But the discussion in the 16 or so months since hasn't been about the heterogeneity that makes up the voting population and made up the swing that was enough to have Trump win the Electoral College. Okay, here's been a long and varied series of places where a field gets to a challenging place and then stops. I'd like to finish with an observation that what I've just done illustrates my very point for myself. In each of these cases, particularly the ones that I was paying attention to in the 1970s and 80s, I got to a place where I showed the existence of this challenging place and possible avenues. But I didn't necessarily keep pursuing them, didn't necessarily pursue the work that was needed to build audience, collaborators, significant attention to the issues of apparent interactions, of construction and turnover, of analyzing heterogeneous resources, of running workshops on situatedness without guarantees, and so on. So I exemplify, in some ways, getting to challenging places and then stopping. But perhaps if there's anyone still listening to this podcast at this point, they might say, look, I've been working on this or that issue too, or I'd like to keep the conversation going. So I welcome that and hope that there's been something interesting in the different episodes I've explained. Thanks a lot.